Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today, something a little different, folks. Off the headline politics for a kind of a treat. On my live show, we're doing a series with all the nominees for an Oscar this year for Best Feature-Length Documentary. So here's our conversation from earlier today with none other than Questlove, who made the nominated film called Summer of Soul, When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised. Hope you enjoy. From WNYC Studios, this is Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast. It's Tuesday, March 15th. Summer of Soul, next up in our yearly look at feature-length documentaries up for an Oscar in that category. Summer of Soul is a concert documentary and historical record about the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival, and we are thrilled to be joined by the film's director, a familiar name to many, musician, songwriter, and founder of The Roots, Amir Questlove Thompson. Questlove, welcome back to WNYC. We're so honored that you do this with us.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you for having me.
So when you're chronicling the story of the Harlem Cultural Festival, I can imagine it might be tempting to just spotlight the music without comment because it's so good. So how did you resist that urge? And if you agree with that assumption that it is an urge, and tell our listeners basically what you set out to do with this documentary.
Well, that was actually my initial intent. But the thing is because of the sort of weather inconsistencies of the 6 weeks that this film was documented, it really wouldn't have looked kind of cohesive, if you will. You know, like it was raining during Stevie Wonder's performance, but you know, it was a heat wave during Edwin Hawkins. And the thing is also, you know, I had the footage first before I even had the context. And kind of the temptation, I'll put it this way. My process for just finding the perfect 17 songs, that would have been my Beatles help period. However, just, you know, my nerdom kept sneaking out, and then somehow this wound up being more an elaborate presentation closer to Abbey Road or the White Album. So, you know, once I found out more information, the thing that really set it off for me was we had interviewed Daryl Lewis, one of the attendees, and he talked about this moment where Stevie Wonder and Gene Key, his musical director, were joking on stage with each other, kind of in this Abbott and Costello, Alvin and Dave Seville sort of way, where Gene Key sort of ridicules Stevie Wonder for singing love songs in Harlem while Man's on the Moon. Like, you know, You're here performing in Harlem, but like, you know, there's a history being made right now. You're not even a part of it. And the audience started booing. And my curiosity as to why they booed, because, you know, I grew up in a time period in which the moon landing was celebrated. And once I opened that door, then I realized that I had to open up all the doors. Which I guess having started the editing process in the pandemic, which basically means that this thing had my attention 24/7, that enabled us to really, truly put our best foot forward as far as storytelling.
So first of all, some of the cultural references you're giving there, the trajectory of the Beatles, simple song like From Help to a developed work of art, and Abbey Road. I guess that was the reference you were making comparing your development of this film, where you were just going to show the music and you decided to make a full-length feature documentary that told a story. Shouting out Abbott and Costello, Alvin and the Chipmunks. All those references.
I do that a lot, you know. I try to stay focused, but I'm also a walking pop culture canon. References. My references have references.
That's right. A fountain of nerdism, as you put it. So, and then what a gift to you, I guess, in a way, in the pandemic, during lockdown to have this to immerse yourself in. And I see that these, because we're talking about a 1969 concert, this footage sat in a basement, as you've described, for some 50 years before it saw the light of day. So how did it get in a basement in the first place, and how was it uncovered?
Well, you know, the original intent for Tony Lawrence and Hal Tolson was to shoot a TV special that could be syndicated around the world. There's one curious point where I realized this really is a TV show. Like, in my mind, this would have been a, you know, like the first concert festival. Like, you know, because this came before Woodstock. So, you know, I'm thinking like, oh, this is the seed that planted, you know, that later sprouted to Coachella. But there's a moment in the Chambers Brothers where Hal Tolson just interrupts their performance, like mid-song, like right in the intro, because he wants Lester Chambers, the leader, to sort of adjust his sombrero or get rid of it so that we can see his face. Huh. And that was such a comical moment to me because, you know, like I could imagine, like if the Coachella people just interrupted Outkast mid-performance during their performance to say, look, we got to shoot that over again. So they, in their minds, it was like, we're shooting a television show and we're going to let 80,000 people watch every week. But in their minds, the television show came first. And I don't know. It's, I think it was a breathless race to the finish, and immediately Woodstock found a home, and sensing like, you know, okay, well, this is Woodstock fever, then surely people are going to want our performance, which we feel is just as good as Woodstock, because, you know, none of those artists at Woodstock were truly household names. I mean, with the exception of Hendrix. And, you know, by that point, you know, half the audience had left. You know, Hendrix came on at like 5 a.m. And so he kept in his collection, his, maybe I should back up a little bit and preface with the very last act that Hal Tolson, the gentleman who shot the footage, did when he signed over, he passed away like less than 24 hours later. And so his widow kind of came to us and basically said like, look, you know, I'm moving, clearing out the basement. There's a lot of paperwork down here. I don't know if this means anything to you, but you guys might want to look at this stuff and see if you can use it. And sure enough, you know, all the answers I ever wanted about this festival are in these like 6 boxes, in which you see the rejection letters. You know, it's basically like, okay, this is nice, but, you know, we're just not interested right now. Which, you know, is kind of sad to me because...
You mean musicians applying to be part of the festival?
Say it again?
Who was rejected? Were they musicians?
Oh, I'm sorry. The rejections of them trying to find a producer or a television network or perhaps a movie company.
Yeah, so it was intended to be a television show by these producers, but they never sold it to a network.
They sold it to one. There was a local station in Buffalo that agreed to take an hour, 1 hour, and they showed it at midnight at on a Sunday, which basically means nobody watched it. But just rejection letter after rejection letter. And, you know, even when the 10-year anniversary came, there were no takers. And, you know, by 10 years, at least 7 of those acts were household names by then. Still no takers. And, you know, he did the occasional 15, 20-year anniversary, you know, still no takers. And so, you know, he had some close but no cigar moments. But basically, when we got those tapes, it, you know, they have been in the basement for 49 years, damn near 50. And, you know, even I had a little bit of doubt at the beginning, because I was just like, well, there has to be a reason why this is falling in my lap and not an established director. So perhaps the sound quality is bad, or the camera work is shoddy, or something has to be wrong for this to fall on my lap. And, you know, the answer was there was nothing wrong with this. And, you know, for at least the first 2 months, I was just wondering, like, well, why? Like, how did I get so lucky?
Though it may have been omitted from the historical record for so many years, it did seem to have a lasting impact, the festival, on some of the performers, in part because of the atmosphere. So here's a little bit of Gladys Knight from the documentary against the backdrop of her performance at the festival.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to bring up some folks.
I was nervous. We were so excited about being there. We join our hands and say prayers before we went on stage.
Gladys Knight!
Now, when I stepped on stage, I was totally, totally taken aback, because I didn't expect a crowd like that.
And the Pips!
I bet you're wondering how I do. Baby, baby, that's playing to make me blue. But some other girl, you knew me wrong.
All right. Once again, I am tempted to just give up the rest of the show and listen to Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Yeah.
Questlove, it may be hard for people to imagine Gladys Knight, one of the most talented singers of all time, getting nervous as she described in that clip. So what was it like to hear her experience?
Well, the reason why this particular moment is lightning in a bottle is you have to understand, for black entertainers, you know, ever since the days of Ma Rainey, you know, and Louis Armstrong, and like the initial, like the original kind of traveling circus tent that was the Ma Rainey show that traveled across the United States. For most black entertainers, the Chitlin' Circuit was all they knew. And if you were an established act, your version of playing Yankee Stadium or Shea Stadium is the like the Apollo in New York, or the Uptown in Philly, the Howard in D.C., or State Theater in Chicago. There's really only like 6 to 8 theater atmosphere, you know, high level theater houses that could hold a certain act. And you would have to be like James Brown, someone with a self-contained unit, or maybe the Motown Review. But for a lot of acts, you know, to hear the Staple Singers say it, to hear these other acts, they were playing in small clubs, barn houses turned into nightclubs or shacks, or like basically, you know, for a lot of them, this is the first time that they're performing to a number over 5,000 people. Like, it's 80,000 people. So this was unprecedented. And for a lot of these acts, they were in a transitional period. Like, Sly Stone had been, you know, producing and writing since his teen years. And even though he released like 3 really brilliant genius albums before, and had one, you know, notable hit, Dance to the Music, you know, in 10 days, his life is going to change, because the Harlem Cultural Festival is just a springboard for Woodstock that would happen in 10 days. And, you know, Stevie Wonder, of course, we know what happens to him in 2 years, and the Staple Singers sort of transfer to soul music, less gospel and soul music and protest music. And Nina Simone, you're seeing her, the very beginning of her, political output, and less jazz and love songs. So this is like a moment in time in which you're watching artists pivot into the next stage that will turn them to household names. And they're really also facing a brand new audience. You know, it would be the equivalent of a group that I hold near. Like, it would be like Wu-Tang an act that, you know, at the height of their powers in 1993, kind of getting a second chance, maybe in 2013, where, you know, your average goer knows Method Man for his acting than his lyrics. So this was a transitional period for everybody.
The names, the artists.
Yeah.
The names in this lineup, just the ones we've talked about so far. We played the Chambers Brothers and Gladys Knight and the Pips. You've talked about Stevie Wonder and the Staple Singers and Nina Simone, for heaven's sakes, and Sly Stone and the Staple Singers. Mm-hmm. And maybe there was Paul and Teaneck. Paul, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, good afternoon. Hey. Yeah, the Harlem Cultural Festival up in Mount Morris Park. I performed there when I was a little kid.
Really?
Yeah, we went down there. My friend, who was our manager, he said, oh, I can get you a slot at the Harlem Cultural Festival. We went down there, dressed in all white, and waited all day long to get on stage, sang Cloud Nine. Crowd loved it.
When was this?
One of my best memories. Well, Cloud Nine was out around then. I don't know which day it was. I don't know who performed there. I remember we were dressed in all white. I was around 11 years old. And by the time we got on stage, we had eaten so many Icy's, we looked like we were rainbows. That's all I remember.
Here's an interesting story. So when I'm looking through Hal Tolshan's notes, there's a memo from the television production people giving kind of forewarning to Hal that they won't be able to shoot the last week of the festival. So, you know, there's 6 weeks in total. And they had already committed to shoot a pilot of a television show in New York, and they couldn't get out of this commitment. And so basically Hal and Tony have to scramble to make sure that their A-listers are in the first 5 weeks, and kind of the local New York, you know, whatever, that's at the end. And what I find out, and Hal's trying to persuade them, like, can you please do the last week? And they're like, we can't, we already committed to this television show. So the television company is shooting the pilot for a show called Sesame Street that weekend. And I later find out that the kind of local nobodies or whatever, like the unknown people, we missed a chance to see Luther Vandross give his very first performance as a 17-year-older.
Wow.
It's like a little tidbits of that I found out that...
You know what? We've got about 7 minutes left before I know you have to go. Hey, Questlove, here's a question from a listener via Twitter. Question is, what's Questlove's favorite performance from the festival? And they add, such a beautiful and important film, and everyone who loves music thanks you. But is this like a favorite child? You can never say it out loud, or do you have one?
I have moments. I will say that probably the most perfect performance was the entire Nina Simone presentation, like all 45. If I could have gotten this past my producers, I would have definitely just put the entire Nina Simone performance in. I enjoyed watching how shocking Sly and the Family Stone was to the audience, because, you know, that crowd was not expecting Sly. They weren't advertised. And this is the first time that people were seeing black people wear their street clothes on stage, which was like, you know, every adult looked like, you know, oh my God, aliens landed. But there's so many moments. But I would have to say that Nina Simone, absolutely every song was a grand slam out the park. Like, if I could have squeezed in five songs, I probably would have.
Is this the first time you're up for an Oscar?
Yes, absolutely. I did not know I had these magical powers within me. I mean, I knew I was a creative. I mean, around 2010, I realized that I'm not a drummer, I'm not a producer, I'm a creative. And, you know, our creators, can creativity be transferable? And I hope that I'm living active proof that maybe that answer is yes.
What would it mean either for you or for the history books if you were to win the Oscar for Best Feature-Length Documentary for Summer of Soul?
I will say that, yes, I enjoy the accolades, but this is absolutely, positively not about me. This is about the reason what took me through this whole process and why I just pushed forward was there was a, when I first started this film, Prince's autobiography came out, and he mentions that his dad took him to see Woodstock. And he's watching Santana, and he saw what his calling was. And, you know, anyone who knows me knows I bleed purple. So, you know, for me, I'm making this film to correct my past. I wanted to be the five-year-old that sits in a movie theater with his mom and dad and watches this and goes on to greatness, you know. So I'm making this for everyone that didn't get the opportunity to have music or art save their lives or heed their calling. And I feel that this film is just as strong 50 years out the gate later to still work its magic. So should this film win, that's the beginning of the journey of this film. Like, all that I'm doing now is just leading up to, this is a 53-year lead up to where this film can go and work its magic now.
53 years after that Harlem Cultural Festival. Gilbert in Peekskill, you're on WNYC with Questlove. Gilbert, we've got about 30 seconds for you. You have a story. Tell it.
Thank you for taking my call. Amir, thank you, brother. My sister Myra was a member of the Black Panther Party at that time, and they were doing security at that concert. Just a note, I'm sure Amir knows, that going uptown to Harlem, that was sung by the Chambers Brothers, was written by the recently departed Betty Davis.
Whoa!
Yeah, man, check it out.
I did not know that. Man, I'm such a fan of Betty Davis, man. That is incredible. Thank you for sharing that.
Gilbert, thank you. And Reggie in the Bronx, who saw the film. Reggie, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, Quest, love, Brian, I love you guys. The film was amazing. I watched it with my roommates, and I just wanted to thank you for making me a big fan of the Fifth Dimension. You, like, had a segment in the show, or in the movie, in the documentary, rather, where you talk, or they talked about how they, like, fused their two songs. They made it, like, one thing where they, like, it was already fused. It was, like, one song led into another, Aquarius, into Let the Sunshine In. I already knew Let the Sunshine In, because, you know, everybody knows that song, but Aquarius, I didn't know that part, and watching that performance and watching them talk about it led me to, you know, go on them DSPs, look them up, and I have a bunch of their songs in my playlist now. So thank you for opening that door for me, Questlove.
You literally validated me, because, you know, my first draft was 3 hours and 30 minutes, and I tell you, like, they asked me to get rid of 2 hours, and that whole story about the lost wallet that leads to that song, they were like, the story's too long, you got to take it out. And I fought hard. I was like, someone is going to love this story. And I thank you for acknowledging that. Thank you.
As we say goodbye to Amir Questlove Thompson, the full Oscar-nominated documentary title is Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised. Enjoy the Oscar ceremony on March 27th. Thanks so much for giving us some time and sharing this with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.